From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, the president of PBS talks about the challenges of running the network in the modern media age. Then the Department of Energy hits the road to campaign for more energy-efficient buildings.
The estimates are we can save about $80 billion a year as a country and create great jobs and put money that was being spent on energy bills back to work in our communities and our businesses.
We learn how Old World Wisconsin came to be and why writer Kathleen Ernst decided a Norwegian Lefse pin would make a perfect murder weapon.
It's quite heavy, and my husband and I have taken it to some events, and we give people a chance to hold it, and almost invariably the first words out of their mouth is, oh, you could do some damage with one of these things.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Public television found itself in a similar place as public radio during the last national election cycle, as a media outlet that was covering both politics and in the political crosshairs. Some legislators believed PBS and NPR represented easy targets for federal budget cuts. But as has been the case in the past, fans and viewers mounted an impassioned defense of the network and its member stations. Still, PBS faces challenges in an increasingly fractious media age. Viewers aren't just tuning to a myriad of cable networks, but also to on-demand viewing sources, which is why you can now watch many public TV shows on Netflix and Amazon and Roku. Paula Kerger was in Milwaukee yesterday to talk about the state of public television. She's president and CEO of PBS, and she sat down with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and talked first about what the network's greatest assets are today.
Our greatest asset is always the content. And as I look across the media landscape and try to envision a future for public media, I always stay focused on what has been a constant through our entire history, which is what are the areas of market failure that commercial media is, for whatever reason, not able to fulfill? That's why we were created to begin with, which seemed very obvious when there were a couple networks and maybe an independent channel or two, and you had to physically get up from your couch to turn the channel. But, you know, flash forward now, 800 channels later, 56% of television primetime is reality shows, and we find ourselves again looking at market failure and what seems like some places that perhaps commercial television could have fulfilled, and actually for a time perhaps did fulfill. So this year, where our audiences are up by 7%, and I think because we've tried to stay true to that constant of quality content that entertains, of course, but also educates and inspires when we really hit our mark.
I suspect if you ask the average person, perhaps walking down Wisconsin Avenue right now, the first thing that comes to mind in the context of public television, they might say Downton Abbey, they might say Sesame Street. That's obviously not the full picture, but what can PBS do to leverage the considerable success that those two very different shows have had and continue to have?
So let's start with Sesame Street. I think when Sesame Street was created, it really did change the way that people thought about television and its potential as an educator, not just as my father used to refer to it as the idiot box, but a place where you could use the technology to bring a true curriculum into the home. And we focus our efforts principally on children under the age of five. The programs that we build are focused on children who may live in homes without computers or books, but that have access to television, which can help to provide some of the core curriculum that will be important for them in school, so basic literacy, some STEM, some of the social-emotional skills that are important for success. So I think that has that coupled with the fact that we work with extraordinarily talented producers that create exciting and compelling content for kids, because if they don't want to watch, they can turn the channel. So that is a big piece of what we do, and the partners that we're able to work with within public broadcasting that create programs like Curious George, which is the number one show on television for children, not just on public television, demonstrates that education and entertainment don't have to be separate activities. They can be meshed together. And we have a lot of children that are coming to us on television, but also on mobile devices and online. We're averaging close to 200 million of children's content alone, 200 million streams, that is, of children's content a month. So a lot of kids come to us there. In terms of Downton Abbey, that is an unbelievable phenomenon. And loyal audiences, January 5th, they will come back. What we've attempted to do with Downton Abbey is, for those that love public broadcasting and love the kind of work that we do on Sunday nights, it's very much a part of that whole effort. But for people that are discovering Downton Abbey for the first time and perhaps discovering public television in a way that they haven't experienced in a number of years, it is an opportunity to bring people in and introduce them to other programs. So Mr. Selfridge, which we announced 2 years ago, Called the Midwife, which was also successful in the UK, Last Tango in Halifax. We have a number of dramas that have brought in new audience. But also, it's given us a chance to really promote other work that we do that we think is of interest to a wider audience. Last week, we just did the JFK documentary from American Experience, and I believe that people that came in via Downton Abbey are sampling other things.
NPR and PBS are obviously two very different entities, but let me just make a comparison. If you go to npr.org right now, the page is geared to the latest breaking news and features from, you know, around the country, around the world. PBS.org is a much different website. There are highlights from individual shows, so what's coming up this evening, some localized content. What is the digital future of PBS? And is it hooked to PBS.org, or is it really about these other places, the Netflix and Amazon and other means of distribution?
I think it's all of the above. Obviously, the NPR site is very focused on news. That's the core of public radio, but there's also cultural programs, obviously, there. And for PBS, we've thought about the online experience in a couple different ways. One is the video player that has both local as well as national content. And one of the challenges that we've been working on navigating, whether it's through the web presence or whether it's through some of these other over-the-top type of distribution, such as Roku or Apple, which was just announced today, is the opportunity to connect people not just to the national content, not just to Ken Burns and others, but also to the local station content. And so we're trying to make sure that wherever public television content is showcased, it's showcased where the local content can sit alongside the national content. And that, for us, has been one of the biggest priorities over the last couple of years working with some of our stations, is figuring out what that experience can be and sort of looking forward, anticipating that there are a lot of people that are still watching television in the way that we've watched television for years, sitting in the living room or sitting in the family room or around the kitchen, watching a schedule that has been organized for them. But there's an increasing audience that is coming to us in other places, and we want to be in all of those destinations, and we want our local stations there alongside of us.
Earlier this year, I think you pointed to a disconnect between stations and PBS itself as maybe the biggest issue confronting the system. Is that what you're getting at there? Is it a question of making the case that both member stations and the network itself are equally important?
What I was commenting on, and you're referencing a speech that I made at our annual meeting, is that I think too often it's easy to point at differences. Our stations are all very different. They're all independent. So we're not a network, you know, and I think most people assume that somehow we're like ABC or NBC and there's some great entity at the top and the stations all fall underneath. We're the reverse model. Same with radio. Every radio station, TV station are all independent. They're all locally owned and operated, which is critically important in this era where, you know, in the commercial side, roughly five companies control everything that we read and watch and listen to. So the public stations being anchored in local communities are important. One can take that too far and believe that every community is completely different from another and that fierce local autonomy should drive everything. And I think what has worked in both public television and public radio is this idea that the independence of the local station is profoundly important. People that control the station, that look at the programming, that do the reporting, all live in the community, they understand the issues. But being able to do that work and at the same time take advantage of the scale that stations coming together in support of an NPR, coming together in support of a PBS can do collectively is what makes us different and unique. And so I think that what I was trying to encourage our stations to recognize is that our fate and our future is very much tied in our ability to try to work through all of this together. So as we look at a media environment that could become very fractionalized, there is a compelling argument that we need to, as a system, look across the table and figure out how we form this common cause in navigating what is a fairly complex environment.
While you're in Milwaukee, you're also announcing the news that PBS will air the Milwaukee Public Television and Milwaukee Ballet production of Peter Pan. Can you put that news in the context of PBS's maybe the relationship with member stations and also the ongoing commitment to things like arts coverage?
So when I was first in this job, one of the very early visits that I made to public television stations was to Milwaukee. I was really interested in seeing the work that was underway here. And Ellis Bromberg, who is the president of the station, had talked to me about the fact that he was very interested in some ideas that I had begun to advance about deepening public television's commitment to the arts, and he was interested in doing the same here in Milwaukee. I met with a group of arts leaders here, and we talked about the potential of what we could be doing at the national level as well as what MPTV could be doing here locally. And he called us one day and said that there was an extraordinary production out of the Milwaukee Ballet of Peter Pan, and would we be interested in taking a look? We were. He was absolutely right. It's an extraordinary production, and we felt that it was the kind of program that a national audience would treasure as much as people have here in Milwaukee.
There's been a lot made about things like arts and music programming disappearing from many schools as budgets become tighter. Does this make what PBS does in terms of arts and music more important within its overall mission?
I grew up seeing programs like The Ed Sullivan Show, where you had the opportunity to see an opera singer or a dancer or Popo Gigio or the Beatles, and that kind of programming really doesn't exist anymore. And I think that as I thought about this and then as the economic downturn in the country happened, I saw arts organizations struggling. And part of the issue for many arts organizations is marketing dollars were often early dollars to be cut. And if you can't put your art form in front of the public, how do you encourage people in, particularly if that experience is not available in schools? Considering that, I challenged our colleagues in public broadcasting to really double down, both at the local level as well as nationally, to explore ways that we could give wider exposure to the arts. I think a production like Peter Pan is similar to other types of productions that not only get people interested in ballet, but Peter Pan is very accessible to kids. So that's why I was really excited that we'd have an opportunity to showcase it.
Paula Kerger, thank you so much, and come back and see us in Milwaukee again soon.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Paula Kerger is president and CEO of PBS. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke yesterday as she was in Milwaukee for an event sponsored by Milwaukee Public Television. Milwaukee gets some positive recognition from the Department of Energy. Our environmental reporter has the story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee received some special attention earlier this month from the U.S. Department of Energy. The agency's Better Buildings Challenge director, Maria Vargas, recognized the city's progress in reducing energy use in its buildings. Milwaukee is among 130 partners, ranging from municipal, commercial to industrial, that signed on to reduce their energy intensity by 20% by the year 2020. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bent set out to learn more about local buy-in to cut consumption. She met with Maria Vargas at Milwaukee's Central Library on Wisconsin Avenue. It's a showcase retrofit project for the city.
Maria Vargas gazes out at the library's 30,000-square-foot green rooftop, resplendent with native grasses and sedum. She says taking in Milwaukee's progress isn't just doling out praise. It recharges her energy pack. She says when President Obama launched the Better Building Challenge, it represented a chance for her and the agency to make tangible environmental strides.
Having worked on energy efficiency for almost 3 decades, I came to the table understanding a lot about what drives greater efficiency, but also, and importantly, what stood in the way of organizations pursuing greater efficiency.
Vargas says it ought to be easy to sell. It takes $200 billion to power the nation's commercial buildings and an equal amount to power industrial facilities.
What's interesting is about 20% of that energy is wasted.
Just attack that waste through energy efficiency measures, she says.
The estimates are we can save about $80 billion a year as a country and create great jobs and put money that was being spent on energy bills back to work in our communities and our businesses.
The challenge director acknowledges the program does ask a lot of its partners
to not only step up and make this commitment, but we're also willing to show people in a very transparent way not only how it is we're saving energy, but how we overcame some of those barriers that existed for our organization.
Coming to a place like the Milwaukee Public Library, Vargas says, reminds her it can be done.
It's a 130-year-old building, which people are hoping is around for another 130 or 230 years. I think it's neat that the city has put a green roof here on the library, but also to drive energy savings so that that money gets respent elsewhere in the city where it can be put to better use rather than wasting energy.
I would say even before I came in 1998, it started.
Taj Shaning is business operations manager for the Milwaukee Public Library.
The library's always had a philosophy of trying to improve energy conservation, reduce consumption, and as technology changed, we've incorporated that. And a lot of it has been with lighting, because lighting is where you really get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of dollar savings.
I was just going to add, too, that
Brooke Vandenberg leads communications and marketing here.
Mayor Barrett then issued a challenge to all city departments in 2006 to reduce energy consumption by 15% by 2012. So the library, I think, has been one of the greatest champions among the departments at achieving that.
So between 2005 and 2009 at Central, we'd already reduced our electrical consumption by 23%.
Shaning says that means lots and lots of light bulbs. Out with the incandescents, in with the LEDs.
And we've tested a lot and found some that work, that are warmer and more inviting.
It's Dwayne Webking's job to manage the massive HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. The library is among 450 downtown buildings that draw steam from the We Energies Valley power plant. Webking says that power source was a major upgrade at the time.
Well, you have to understand that there's 10 acres of building here. The original building was in the 1890s. It was coal and fireplaces. So when steam came about or available, that was one step of modernization. And then since then, we're using more sophisticated air handlers that can modulate to demand. So there's been an evolution of the heating plant for Central Library.
He guides me to the very clean bowels of the library, opening a trap door that leads down to steam service.
We'll go down this corridor here.
Okay.
Where the 10-inch steam pipe meets library infrastructure.
The east side of our building. So we're up against 8th Street, and this is where the Wheat Energy's steam service comes into the building. And then from there on, it's our high-diameter steam pipe goes pretty much the length of the building because it gets to the different mechanical areas that we've got to serve. As you can tell, it's very warm in here, so we're running pretty hot. And this insulation that's here is quite old. We feel we can make a big improvement here by re-insulating with new insulation materials. So we're going to be looking at also insulating our condensate pipes and our steam traps.
Those traps, 260 interspersed throughout the library's heating pipes, are fashioned of cast iron outside and stainless steel mechanisms inside.
Anywhere where you have a place for water to pool, we need to tap that low point and take the condensate off. Otherwise, the condensate would accumulate and pool and prevent the steam from going down the pipe.
Eric Nordine knows his way around steam traps, although it still surprises him. 2 years ago, he knew nothing of tending to an old building until he bought one, the Wells Building on East Wisconsin Avenue.
It's a half-empty old historic office building with all this great architectural detail, but it also had a lot of failing systems in the building, HVAC, plumbing, electrical, those kinds of things that are sort of hidden behind the walls of the building. So we wanted to create an aesthetic for the building and make it marketable and leasable, but we knew we had to spend a lot of money on this behind-the-scenes stuff.
Its basement holds remnants of a Western Union office, one of many historical elements that captures Nordine's imagination.
See all that old copper? That's all communications lines. It's amazing they were all the way down in this sub-basement, but this was a, you know, these are like, it's really dirty, but these are nice marble slabs. I don't know if people would sit here waiting for their turn or whatever. And that's that same white
but
marble.
But one passage away, body, it's Nordine's so gleaming so heating and cooling system that will bring the wells back to life and save 17 million gallons of water a year in the process.
This is all new here. This is pumping equipment for the new closed water loop. We have steam heat as a source in the building, but in the new spaces we're building, we're abandoning the old steam radiators. The steam still comes into the building, but we have a steam to hot water heat exchanger back here, which allows us to just centralize the steam, comes in the building, heats the water in the loop. Then we don't have to push steam throughout the whole building. We can keep the steam here. And it also allows you to be heating one portion of the building while cooling another. And in that case, you're just moving heat from one part of the building to another. You can use less steam. It's more efficient.
Just a few blocks away, Adam Sauter, with Johnson Controls, is orchestrating the retrofit of another architectural icon, the Milwaukee Athletic Club. That included updating 60 individual hotel rooms, where guests would often run the air conditioning midwinter because the steam heat blasted uncontrollably.
We actually started to disconnect and install radiator valves, and then we installed thermostats as well so that we could create a disconnect between the heat and the cooling so that they did not compete against each other.
Sauter compares projects like these to open-heart surgery.
Because we're coming into a building that's fully functional, and you take the Milwaukee Athletic Club, we have hotel rooms, we have a fitness center, we have a restaurant, and we have meeting rooms, and we come in and literally disassemble the mechanics of it. So it's open-heart surgery. The heating, the cooling, we're disrupting all of those mechanical entities while they're in operation, and we have to do it without interrupting their flow.
Eric Schambarger with Milwaukee's Environmental Sustainability Office says the city comes into the picture financially and with a pre-approved list of contractors through its ME2 program. The financial formula has evolved. When ME2 started, the city plugged in federal stimulus funds. That's been replaced by a unique funding mechanism.
Property assessed clean energy financing. It's a public-private partnership where we've got up to $100 million of private capital for building improvements, energy efficiency building improvements in existing buildings. And it's unique because the property owner repays it as a voluntary municipal special charge on their property tax bill, extends loan terms out to up to 20 years, and it has a whole lot of other advantages as well to the building owner.
Schambarger says local workers also benefit in the process thanks to RPP. That stands for Residents Preference Program.
The thinking is the city's going to put a program together to help building owners. We want to make sure that some of the job creation that comes out of that goes to people who live in the city and really need jobs right now.
That suits Kevin Mamoreau and Eddie Hughes just fine. They work for a local company contracted to do electrical work on the Milwaukee Athletic Club project. Before the job came along, Kevin Mamoreau was out of work for months.
I became a journeyman in November. Hadn't worked a day since. I got hired through the residential preference program, doing city upgrades, fire departments mainly. I was off work for a long time, so that helped me get back to work.
As for Eddie Hughes, he's stunned. This is his first day on the job, and the last thing he imagined was having a microphone shoved in his face.
I went to MATC. I have a certificate in construction electricity, and this is what I wanted to do.
For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You'll find more about the DOE's Better Buildings Challenge and Milwaukee's Me Too and other energy conservation programs on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, a new book reveals how Old World Wisconsin came to be. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect right after this on WUWM. more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Since the mid-1970s, Old World Wisconsin has preserved and brought to life the state's rich ethnic heritage. As the largest outdoor museum of rural life in the country, Old World demonstrates how our immigrant ancestors lived through heirloom gardens, antique machinery, and painstakingly restored buildings. But a living history museum doesn't come together by itself, and perhaps we've taken for granted the history of the institution itself. Well, that's rectified in a new book by Marquette University professor John Krugler called Creating Old World Wisconsin. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce who came up with the idea for the museum.
Well, the man that's generally credited with is a Milwaukee architect by the name of Richard W. E. Perrin. And Mr. Perrin started going into the field in about 1928-29. And what he was very much interested in, besides his jobs in Milwaukee as an architect, he was very interested in vernacular or folk architecture. And his crusade was launched when he said, as he said at one point, he said, every year I went out into the field and more of these specimens disappeared. And so it was almost as if a blanket or a shroud had begun to cover the 19th century. And this was especially true after World War II when Americans began to move into the rural areas and these old houses had no attraction to them. So they were either torn down or they'd be remodeled and you wouldn't even be able to tell what the original fabric was. So Mr. Perrin in 1960 measured the Kepsel House in the town of Jackson near the Jackson Marsh in Washington County. He convinced the farmer to donate the building to the Historical Society. Now, in that same month, he approached the society, who had a new director, Dr. Leslie H. Fischel, who was the seventh director of the society. And Fischel probably would have been well advised to simply say, well, Mr. Perrin, this is wonderful, but we just don't have the resources. But Perrin was persistent, and in 1964, he went before the Board of Curators and made a very convincing argument that they needed to endorse this idea of capturing, saving, preserving, rescuing, salvaging, however you want to describe it, and bringing them to a common site. So that's what I would say would be the origins of it. One man who had worked with other architects and saw the need for state intervention in terms of preservation.
Now, had the Society ever taken on a project like this before?
Traditionally, this Wisconsin Historical Society was nationally known for its archives and library, and it had a wonderful archival collection, and that's where they spent most of their time and energy, that and the books. The state's historical library was the library, the American History Library for the University of Wisconsin, so you can see it was a very, very massive and important undertaking. There were many who worried that if the society got into historic sites, it was going to be a disaster from a budgetary standpoint because I won't say they lived a hand-to-mouth existence, but it was close to that. They were pretty much at subsistence level. Beginning in late 1940s, the society began to think about we have to have more to our mission than just serving scholars. We need to get into what was derisively called popular history. And popular history was most generally effective by using historic sites. So by 1953, the society had acquired three sites. They were existing sites. The DNR owned them. And so the society began to manage them and administer the sites. But no, they had never tried to create a museum from scratch. And so this became an incredible challenge because, A, they didn't have enough money to do it. B, they had no experience. There were no manuals. There were no how do you build a museum booklets out there for them. So they simply went into it kind of on a wing and a prayer.
What were the options before them? They had this capsule building that was donated to them by Mr. Perrin. What then were the options before them in terms of what they could do with this building?
Well, the most important thing and the one that took the most time was acquiring the site. Now, they had looked at Bong Air Base, which was going to be released by the United States government, but that didn't happen until the mid-70s, so that really wouldn't have been an effective choice. Their eye kind of was set on that wonderful state forest, the Southern Kettle Moraine Forest at Eagle, and that was where most of their planning went. Now, this was a great situation because much of the forest they wanted was owned by the Department of Natural Resources, a state agency. The society was a state agency, so, gee— it should be very easy to affect this, but because of state law and because of reluctance on the part of the DNR, they could not affect this lease until 1971. So it was 10 years that the struggle to get the site went on. So that was probably the biggest consideration. It took an awful lot of time. But I think in terms of your question, the capsule house, I said it was donated. I didn't say it was taken to any place by the society. In 1969, the society said, you know, we better go out there and see what's happened with the capsule house. And so they sent Jack Wynn out there, and he was able to reestablish a relationship with the family and eventually got the building to be donated. What I'm suggesting here is that this was a long and in many ways a very torturous process, in large part fueled by the fact the society really didn't have enough money to be doing this. And so it was kind of a hand-to-mouth existence for them to get the museum started. The crews scoured the state, and they began to find buildings they wanted in Polk County, Dane County, Dodge County, Rock County. So they were all over the state looking for buildings.
You talked about the lack of funding, but I wonder that example of what happened with the capsule house seems to be a perfect example of the lack of experience going into this. What maybe could have been done differently had there been someone who really knew how to bring these buildings to this site properly?
Let me start by quoting my favorite 19th century humorist, Mark Twain, who said, "The lack of money is the root of all evil." So most of the problems that the society encountered was due to the fact that they simply didn't have enough money to be able to do what they wanted to do. The people that supported it were very enthusiastic, and they really, really were pushing very hard. In terms of what they could have done differently, I think if they had done anything differently, the museum would not have happened. There's almost a genius in the way they did this. And Les Fischel, when I interviewed him, said that, you know, his approach was to do it incrementally, one step at a time. I had seen that in the records, but I hadn't recognized it. And so after he said that, then I realized, wow, you know, this is just exactly what they were doing. So they went after the site. That got to be a long and drawn out, protracted struggle. The most interesting thing about what could they have done differently, the obvious choice would have been to go to a professional planner. You know what? That costs a lot of money. So the question became, how can we get a master plan virtually for free? Fischel called the head of the landscape architecture department. He said, we have this project that we're thinking about doing, and I need somebody who might be able to put together a master plan. And the head of the department says, well, we just hired this new young guy from Harvard. He's been here about a year now, but he really loves old buildings. Well, loving old buildings and building a museum plan are two different things. This is one of the things that got me into writing this book, is because I interviewed Bill Tischler in 1993 and 1994. I was working on a different project at the time, and I was so fascinated by his story. As a college professor, you know, you kind of know how far you can push your students, and I try to push them to the nth degree. But Bill started with a design studio class in second semester of 1966-67, and he had 16 undergraduate students, 15 men and one woman. And that class put together four preliminary plans for the museum, and they made a presentation to the faculty of the Landscape Architecture Department in June of 1967. That was enthusiastically endorsed, and then they went on to meet with the curators and sold the plans to them, and they again enthusiastically endorsed the plans.
Well, once they had the site established by 1971, I believe you said.
Well, the site was transferred, and then they began working on the site in 72.
It was a short amount of time to 1976 when the site actually opened. That's a lot to have happened in a five-year period. Talk about the dominoes that fell to get this museum together.
Well, first of all, let me start with Alan Pape, who was the construction supervisor. He went to his supervisor and said, you know, we need a lot of people to be re-erecting these buildings. And his supervisor said, hire cheap, you know. And so Alan, at least for the first couple of summers, relied on local high schoolers to do the work. Anything, and Mr. Perrin endorses, if the public couldn't see it, then you can do anything you want. Now, I mean, you know, that's not exactly the kind of workmanship you'd like. You'd like somebody who's maybe got 20 years in on reconstructions, restorations. So they had to rely on very inexperienced workers. So that was a complicating problem. It meant that Alan would have to be there supervising frequently. But Alan also was in the field. Why was he in the field? He was looking for buildings. And the number of trips they'd gone up to Bayfield County and found some wonderful specimens that are in the museum from the finish, and they also found Ed Pudas, who was a Finn, who was a carpenter. And so they co-opted him and brought him down. And so he was more or less the supervisor for the construction of the finished buildings that they had brought back. In addition to trying to find the buildings, which was very exhausting, and Alan was, a number of people have told me, he told me himself, no brag, just fact, he could see a 19th century building where others couldn't. But from 1973, when the first construction started in June, until June 30th, 1976, 3 years to get the museum built.
So what was opening day like?
The people that were responsible for planning, they thought maybe 2,000, but we, you know, planned for 5,000. They had accepted estimate was between 8,000 and 12,000 people to Eagle. Now, they probably should have been able to figure out that this was going to be a big attraction, A, for the publicity, but you know, Wisconsins love anything that's free. And so these Wisconsinites came in great numbers. They literally flooded the site. There were so many problems on site, it's mind-boggling. The Ramsey Barn was going to be the visitor center. It wasn't ready. There was no water on site because the well digger took off a couple weeks before the site opened. St. Peter's Church, the painters went on strike, so they didn't have the painting completed. They received their slideshow the morning of the opening, and they had no place to show it. So, you know, they thought, well, we'll use the basement of St. Peter's Church, which was now nearing completion. The problem there was they had no electricity. So what they did is they brought a generator. Generators make big noise. And so you have these people filing down into the basement of St. Peter's to see the slideshow with a, you know, an audio and can't hear it.
How did then Old World Wisconsin survive this day when everything that could go wrong went wrong? I mean, what went right? Something obviously went right because Old World Wisconsin survived after this and today is thriving.
What went right about this? Well, a lot of things went right. By the time the second season opens in 1977, they've already made great strides. It was a tease in 1976, a kind of showing you this is what we might be able to become. I think they had, the numbers are 67 re-erected buildings, historic buildings. It wasn't what they planned, but it was much more than the state deserved out of, you know, what the resources were.
Well, John Krugler, thank you so much for coming in and telling us the story of creating Old World Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
John Krugler is a professor of early American history and public history at Marquette University. His latest book is Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. There's a link to more information about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then a fictional Old World Wisconsin curator travels to Iowa and finds the dark side of Norwegian culture. Murder. Lake Effect returns right after this. You're listening to us on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin novelist Kathleen Ernst has written numerous historical books for children, but it's a series of more modern-day mysteries that has adults anxiously awaiting new installments. The latest book in her Chloe Ellefson series has recently come out. If you're not familiar with the series, Ellefson is a curator at Old World Wisconsin around whom things just seem to happen. In her first two books, the reluctant sleuth found herself helping to solve murders at Old World Wisconsin. A third book brought her to a lighthouse on Wisconsin's Rock Island. But the latest installment, Heritage of Darkness, finds Ellefson traveling out of state to the small town of Decorah, Iowa, just before Christmas. Kathleen Ernst picks up the story from there for Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
Well, Chloe is visiting Vesterheim Norwegian American Museum in northeast Iowa. It is a marvelous museum, and Chloe is going to stay very firmly rooted in Wisconsin. She will keep her job at Old World Wisconsin, but as the series progresses, it's nice for her to travel to other historic sites and places. And I look for places that I think are wonderful, museums or sites that I can share with readers. And I also look for places that will fit a theme that is developing within the series. And in this case, at the end of the third book, Chloe had come to the conclusion that she really wanted to work on some of her relationships. And so when Heritage of Darkness begins, Chloe and her mother are on the way to Decora. Her mother is a master rosemaler, which is a type of Norwegian folk art painting. And Chloe has decided that she's going to take a beginner's class while mom takes an advanced class, and this will be a week of bonding. And her friend Ralky McKenna, who is a police officer, he wants to be supportive. So when he notices that there's a carving class going on the same week, he decides that he'll come along too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Vesterheim. It is not exactly a living history museum in the same sense as Old World Wisconsin, but at the same time, you might argue that the community of Decora almost fills that role. Norwegian immigrant tradition is very much a part of modern life there.
It is. It's really celebrated by the whole community, and there is still a very strong Norwegian contingent there. Vesterheim is also unique in a couple of ways. It has the largest collection of artifacts that has been collected to represent any single group in the country. There is also an outdoor component. It is not living history in the way that a site like Old World Wisconsin is, but it's actually the oldest outdoor museum in the country.
Well, and I want to get back to some of the things, the artifacts that are at the heart of this mystery in just a minute. But we should also note that, as you say, Chloe was joined in Iowa and in the midst of this mystery by her. We will call him a boyfriend, even though they're not really fond of that term. Rolke is a police officer. He ends up being called on to assist in the case. And as it's been in the previous books, the relationship between Chloe and her beau is a little tenuous, or at least it's still developing. Is that a key for you to keep their relationship in kind of a formative place?
I think I need to do that for quite some time. Readers, from the feedback I've gotten from readers, one of the things that they enjoy most is watching these two people grow personally and also as their relationship grows as they figure things out. And they are definitely still figuring out how to be together. They're very different people, and yet in some ways they're really, really good together. And that's going to take some time for them to sort all these issues out.
Do you feel like you know Chloe better after four mysteries than you did when you set out?
Oh, what an interesting question. I do. I spend so much time thinking about Chloe and her world. It takes about a year to write each book, more than that if you think about when the preliminary research starts. So, yeah, Chloe lives in my head quite a bit. And actually, that's one of the real joys of a series is that I get to see Chloe and also Ralky develop and grow and become, I hope, more complex as time goes by, just because we have more time to think about it and to spend with them.
Do you see things around you and think about how Chloe would react?
Constantly. Yeah, I tell people Chloe is not me, even though we have a lot of things in common. But because Chloe is in my mind pretty much all the time, there is a filter in my brain, I think, and it just sort of constantly picks up how Chloe would react to this, what Chloe would think about this, or, ooh, that's interesting. I could use that in a future book.
As long as it's not unsafe to be around you.
Right. I think this is a very healthy, safe way to channel some of these things.
Well, so let's go back to Decora and the Vesterheim. It is not very long after Chloe and Ralky and Merritt mm-hmm. arrive. Merritt is Chloe's mom. That murder takes place. Who is it that's the victim, and what is the unusual murder weapon?
Well, the victim is one of the teachers, a very talented lady named Petra, does not show up at the opening reception, and unfortunately, very quickly, Chloe and Ralky find her where she has been attacked and left in an immigrant trunk. And the murder weapon is a lefse pin, which for the uninitiated looks like a rolling pin. It has grooves in it, and they're often much bigger and heavier than a rolling pin. And they were used specifically to make a type of Norwegian flatbread named lefse, made with a potato dough.
And this, as we learn, is a pretty heavy object.
It is, yes. It's quite heavy, and my husband and I have taken it to some events and some book fairs and things, and we give people a chance to hold it, and almost invariably the first words out of their mouth is, oh, you could do some damage with one of these things.
And like any good murder mystery victim, there were no shortage of people who might have sought to do Petra harm.
No, Petra was not a nice person in any regard. So the suspects added up pretty quickly as Chloe and Relke start learning more about her and the way she interacted with people.
Let's go back to what else is going on as this is playing out. While Chloe and Relke and the Decorah police are trying to figure out who killed Petra, Chloe is in the uncomfortable position for her of taking a rosemaling class taught by her mother.
Taught by her mother. That shift happened when Petra was taken out of the picture. And the museum director had to figure out how to make all this work. And so Chloe's mom takes over the beginning class.
Well, tell us more about this uniquely Norwegian tradition of rosemaling. What is it within the broader context of painting?
Well, it's a decorative form of painting. It goes back many, many, many years in Norway. And there are regional traditions that developed so that, you know, in one valley, this type of painting happened, and over the next valley, it might be slightly different. But it's all a decorative form of painting. And if we think back to rural people, very plain homes. In fact, there's a conversation that I really like towards the end of the book, where Chloe assumes that her mother loves painting because of the glory that she gets from being a champion. And her mother says, let's think about peasant people and how dark their homes were and how long the winter days were and what it would mean to have an itinerant painter show up with all these pigments and colors and hues and the ability to paint flourishes on the walls or on the furniture. So it's really a treasured folk art form. It almost died out in America. But during the Great Depression, a wagon maker in Stoughton, he was painting wagons, and he used to be a master rosemaler. When work was slow, he started painting flourishes on some of the wagons, and he's really credited with the revival.
We should also mention what Relke is studying, and this is a discipline known as chip carving.
Chip carving, right. And of the different forms of wood carving, I decided to have Relke study chip carving because I believed it would really suit his nature. Chip carving is very geometric. It's very precise. Very intricate designs are made by just carving out tiny little chips. And Relke, who goes over really just on a lark, decides that he loves it.
He is allowed to divide his time essentially between chip carving and helping solve this mystery.
Right. Yeah, the police understand that while they have the primary responsibility, Chloe and Relke are in Vesterheim that week. They're in the heart of the community. And so Relke is asked to just sort of keep his eyes and ears open and report back.
And there is a wooden artifact that plays a role in this mystery. It's in a way kind of a primitive and very blunt message delivery system.
Yes, you're referring to the Buddha stick. It's a message tube. It's the best translation. And it had a sharp point on one end and a hollow tube that someone could write a note and stick it in there. And in the very old days, if a king or a leader had word that was very important and he wanted to make sure that everybody got it, he would send out runners. And if a farmer wasn't home, he might come home and find this thing literally stuck, stabbed into his door. And as I was looking at artifacts and deciding which ones could help tell the story, that just had so much potential.
As this book plays out, they're in the middle of the Christmas season, which is a big time at the Vesterheim.
It is. Vesterheim celebrates Norwegian Christmas weekend every year, the first weekend in December, and it is my favorite special event there of all the things that they do. There's all kinds of crafts and music, but they also explore some of these old traditions, and so it's a marvelous time to be at the museum.
How much time did you spend in Decorah as you researched this to set this book here?
Well, I've been going to Decorah for a number of years. The very first Chloe mystery involved an antique ale bowl, and my husband and I went over just to study the ale bowls in the collection. But it's such a phenomenal museum. That was 4 years ago. And so I've been probably 25 times since. I love taking classes there. I take folk art classes there, rose mulling and handwork stitching and some food classes. One of the nice things there is you have this incredible collection. So you can spend your days learning how to paint and then take a break in the middle of the afternoon and be allowed to see things in the collection or in storage. And that's really a rare opportunity.
What do the people at the Vesterheim think of having a murder mystery set there?
They are actually thrilled. They were very excited when we started talking about this. In fact, one of the staff members there suggested it very early on. Why don't you have Chloe come to Vesterheim? So they've been marvelous. They've been very supportive. And I think they understand that a lot of the people that love the series, they love history. They love museums. And I've heard from many readers who sort of make it an annual tradition now. We'll read the book and then we'll go travel and see the site where Chloe went.
Kathleen Ernst, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Wisconsin novelist Kathleen Ernst's latest book is Heritage of Darkness. It's the fourth book in the Chloe Ellefson series of mysteries. Ernst is at work on a fifth, part of which we're told will be set in Milwaukee. There's a link to more about the book, including pictures of some of the objects we talked about, from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.